Hi, welcome back here with Truth News Radio. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the second hour of today's show, I've got a very important interview. As I mentioned earlier, the author of The Man Who Killed Kennedy, Roger Stone, is on the line. This book is, to me, one of the most interesting and important books that has come out on the subject of the Kennedy assassination. I feel that it actually hits the mark in several ways, and quite often with books and films, and there's been so many of them on the Kennedy assassination, I feel as if that they don't really get to the meat of it. They don't get to the core issues, although many theories have touched on things that are important. I sort of feel that this, because it gets down to the level of that very, very personal animosity that existed between Lyndon Baines Johnson and Kennedy, the motive is brought into focus in a way that is really compelling. And it takes it to a level that the psychology of how the assassination could actually practically have taken place starts to become clear as you discover the true horror of the personality of LBJ. So to talk all about that, I have on the line Roger Stone. Welcome to Truth News Radio.
Great to be with you.
Indeed, and it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Mr. Stone, you've had a background in politics in Washington. You were a close associate of Richard Nixon. You were involved in Ronald Reagan's campaign. You have a very detailed knowledge of how it actually operates, how the system operates in the real world. Your book really is quite shocking in terms of what I would say just the gross abnormality, that the psychological abnormality of Lyndon Johnson. And I'd just like to start to talk about that. Thank you.
He was an amoral psychopath. He was a coarse, loudmouth bully who enjoyed humiliating and deriding the people who worked for him. He was a man of epic appetites for cigarettes, alcohol, and women. He was epically corrupt. I mean, corruption of biblical proportions. He was crude, vulgar, vindictive. This is not a model citizen we're talking about. As one Secret Service agent told me, if he hadn't been president of the United States, he would have been locked up in a mental institution.
It really is incredible, isn't it, that that someone who clearly, I mean, I've read the first few chapters of your book that get into the extremely bizarre behavior that he exhibited while he was actually president. And I mean, in your experience, does he stand out as being something quite exceptional in terms of those behaviors for a president of the United States?
Look, I think we have had some very odd men as president of the United States, but Johnson really stands out. He was ruthless. He was a pathological liar. Back in Texas, they called him Lion Lyndon. He was petty. He was sadistic. This is a man who conducted White House meetings while sitting on the toilet defecating. And he did that because he enjoyed the humiliation and embarrassment that it caused the young Kennedy aides that he had inherited from JFK, all these young Ivy Leaguers. So this is, I think, a true nutcase. And I tie him to at least 8 murders prior to JFK, murders to cover up corruption, murders to cover up vote stealing, murders to cover up fraud. Murder was in his DNA. Lyndon Johnson could order a murder the way you and I would order a ham sandwich. So while we have had some other presidents who I think have been lacking or flawed, as all human beings are, and people always point to President Richard Nixon as perhaps our least popular president, our most disgraced president, when it came to corruption, when it came to lying, Lyndon Johnson makes Richard Nixon look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
Indeed, indeed. Now, your view about the assassination is that Lyndon Johnson largely orchestrated it. He, of course, had the motive. I mean, you've described him as a narcissistic psychopath who harboured a lot of rage, a lot of anger, a lot of jealousy towards the president. So he had a very personal motive for wanting to, obviously, to become president himself. What can we... can you just step through for our audience how he engineered that, or what was his part in the assassination as you saw it?
Well, first of all, I think we have to delineate the motive. In the fall of November of 1963, Lyndon Johnson is facing political extinction. He is going to be ruined by the Kennedys. He's not only going to be dumped from the 1964 Democratic ticket, but he is also going to be prosecuted and sent to prison in two major scandals of the day, the Bobby Baker scandal. Baker was Johnson's right-hand man in the U.S. Senate and his bagman. Baker has accepted millions of dollars in bribes for Lyndon Johnson, and the Senate is investigating him. And Johnson is also jammed up in the Billy Sol Estes scandal. Sol Estes is a flamboyant Texas wheeler-dealer, and he and Johnson have shared millions of dollars in corrupting due to federal agriculture allotment contracts. So Johnson is staring into the abyss. He is not just going to be politically defeated and ruined. He's going to be prosecuted and sent to prison. So I argue that he yokes a conspiracy that does involve others. The CIA, with whom Johnson has very close ties starting in the early 1950s, has their own motives. Organized crime has their own motives. Big Texas Oil has their own motives. And Lyndon Johnson has a unique relationship with each one of them. The CIA is upset with Kennedy over his failure in the Bay of Pigs invasion to order air support for the Cuban rebels. They're upset about the Cuban Missile Crisis, where, despite the media-created myth in the United States that JFK faced the Russians down and they blinked, that's a lie. We removed U.S. missiles from Turkey and Greece, changing the balance of power in the European theater. That was withheld from the American people for 40 years. So John Kennedy made a deal with the Soviets. They agreed to withdraw their missiles from Cuba, and in return, we agreed to withdraw our missiles from Europe. The problem is that their missiles were never really removed. There was no on-site inspection. So the Pentagon, the CIA, the military-industrial complex, if you will, are very upset about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Organized crime has its own ties to Lyndon Johnson. He takes $55,000 a month in bribe money from them to protect their illegal gambling operations in Texas. And they have given they have given John Kennedy $1 million for his election, and they have stolen votes for him in Illinois, in West Virginia, and other states. And they feel that they've been double-crossed because Bobby Kennedy is seeking to deport some of their top leaders and cracking down on and trying to jail the others. So they have a motive. They also have key ties to Lyndon Johnson. And then, of course, lastly, there is Big Texas Oil.
Yeah.
Lyndon Johnson is their chief water carrier in Washington, and JFK wants to repeal a tax break that they have, the oil depletion allowance, which saves them millions and millions of dollars in taxes. So everyone involved in this plot has their own motive. Everyone involved in this plot has their unique relationship to Lyndon Baines Johnson. And, of course, the crime happens in Johnson's town. It happens in Dallas, a place that he controls.
Yeah, look, the thing I really like about your thesis is that it does actually incorporate all of those really important analyses of the motive for Kennedy. And of course, you also recognize... Can I just briefly get your view on the military-industrial complex and the war in Vietnam? Because that's also been another angle that a lot of people have taken, that that Kennedy wanted to scale back American involvement in Vietnam. What's your take on that?
I think it is a factor. I actually think the JFK assassination is more about Cuba policy than Vietnam, but Vietnam is a factor. It is a fact that prior to going to Dallas, Kennedy has signed an executive order to begin the orderly withdrawal of American troops with an eye towards having all Americans out of Vietnam by 1965. And, of course, that will cost Lyndon Johnson himself, who owns enormous defense contractor stocks, and his financial supporters in the defense contractor industry. It's going to cost them millions of dollars. The literally 24 hours after Johnson becomes president, he signs an executive order reversing John Kennedy's orders for the withdrawal from Vietnam. However, I think it's more important to look at Cuba, where the CIA actually puts forward a plan called Operation Northwoods, where they propose attacks on American assets and the murder of Americans, blaming that on the Cubans as a pretext for JFK to invade Cuba.
Indeed.
So, and they're very upset about the failure of their ability to assassinate Castro, which they've been trying to do since 1958 unsuccessfully. I think it has as much to do with Cuba policy as it does with Vietnam policy.
Indeed, and I believe Kennedy vetoed the Northwoods proposals, and that certainly earned him the ire of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yes, exactly, which infuriated them even more, although I would argue that the murder of John F. Kennedy is the greatest single manifestation of the Northwoods plan. It's also important to recognize that in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, many people have asked me, well, how can you accuse the Warren Commission, which investigated the assassination appointed by President Johnson, how can you accuse these learned men, these respected men, of treason, of cover-up? I mean, it's very simple. Johnson promulgates the myth with each one of them that John Kennedy was killed by the Russians, by the Russian state, and perhaps utilizing their Cuban puppets.
Right.
And that the crime must be covered up, otherwise the American people will demand retaliation, which in turn would mean Armageddon, would mean World War III. Millions would die from the nuclear fallout, and therefore we have an obligation to cover this up because the Russians really did it. There is, of course, no evidence of that whatsoever. You're going to hear the mainstream media in the United States try to roll that myth out. They're trying already. They can't defend the Warren Commission anymore. They can't really defend the idea that Oswald acted alone. There's too much evidence to the contrary. So the fallback is, okay, Oswald was a communist and he was really acting on behest of the USSR. That's a lie, but it's a lie that Johnson used very, very aggressively to get Warren Commission to do his bidding. In fact, they're coming up a domestic conspiracy.
Indeed. We're just going to break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. I'm talking to author Roger Stone about the man who killed Kennedy. Really important interview. Stay with us. We'll be back after this very short break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Back here with Truth News Radio, and I'm talking to author Roger Stone about the man who killed Kennedy. And indeed, it is the man in this case. Of course, there was that great television documentary called The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which I have watched. a couple of times and certainly learned a lot from. Mr. Stone, you really chosen to focus on LBJ. We've been covering there in the past, in the previous segment, a lot of those peripheral issues, a lot of the other motives, a lot of the other reasons why many forces kind of came together because it served their interest to see Kennedy gone. Can we just now, we've only got another few minutes to talk to you, can we now just focus in on the actual assassination itself and Johnson's involvement in that? Obviously, he was a very key player because with the position of power he had, then being sworn in as president, he would be able to direct the investigation in all kinds of ways. And, of course, as you said, his connection to Dallas, Texas. So if you could just guide us through that.
Sure. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that in 1963, murder is a state crime, not a federal crime. There's no statute against murder of a president. There is today, but there wasn't then. And therefore, the investigation into what happens in Dallas is going to be conducted by the Dallas Police Department, the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, and the Dallas County District Attorney, Henry Wade, all three of whom are controlled by Lyndon Johnson. So I think he controls the investigation even before becoming president. He also has a very close relationship with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover fears mandatory retirement in 1964 at the hands of the Kennedys, who despise him. He knows Lyndon Johnson will give him a waiver to continue as FBI director into the late 70s, actually. So Johnson is in a unique position. I believe that the actual shooter, at least one of the shooters, is Malcolm Mack Wallace, a longtime associate of Lyndon Johnson's, a convicted murderer, someone Johnson has placed in a series of political patronage jobs. He leaves a fingerprint in the Texas School Book Depository sixth floor sniper's nest on one of the cardboard boxes. It's a 34-point match print, which means it's admissible in the U.S. courts. Additionally, six individual witnesses see a man who meets Wallace's description in the windows of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository in the minutes just before the shooting. They see a man who meets his perfect description, heavy set, balding, wearing horn-rimmed spectacles. That's Mack Wallace. That's not the 127-pound, 130-pound Lee Harvey Oswald. Additionally, one witness, Richard Carr, not only sees the man in the window just before the shooting of the sixth floor, but he sees the man flee the building minutes later and jump into a late model Rambler station wagon and drive away. That witness, Richard Carr, gives a report to the Dallas Police Department, and for the next 10 years, there are no less than four attempts on his life, which he survives. The Warren Commission ignores all of this firsthand testimony because Lee Harvey Oswald is exactly what he says he is. He's a patsy. He's on the second floor of the Texas School Book Depository building when the shooting goes on, eating his lunch, exactly like he said he was.
Yeah.
And the statements he makes when he goes to the Dallas Police Department, I didn't shoot anybody, I'm a patsy, I don't know what you're talking about. Reporter yells, did you shoot the President of the United States? He says, no, sir, I did not. We now know from voice stress analysis technology available today but not available in 1963 that Oswald is telling the truth. So I think Malcolm Wallace, Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman, is the shooter. Immediately afterwards, Wallace goes back to his job at Temco, a giant defense contractor owned by H.D. Byrd. H.D. Byrd is a Texas billionaire who also owns the Texas School Book Depository building.
Right.
And his company, Temco, gets a $325 million defense contract for the Vietnam War only 3 months after John F. Kennedy is in his grave. So I believe that's the payoff. Malcolm Wallace is at least one of the shooters of JFK.
And can I ask you about on the day of the assassination, where was Johnson officially, and what do you think his movements were in reality in that sort of 24-hour period?
Well, he does two curious things that day. First of all, he goes to President Kennedy's hotel room in the morning, and he tries to persuade him that Governor John Connally, who is a Johnson ally and protege, should ride with the vice president, and that Senator Ralph Yarborough, the Texas senator who's an arch enemy of Lyndon Johnson's, should ride with the president in the death car.
Right.
Kennedy refuses, and they have a shouting match. Secondarily, we know that when JFK's car enters Dealey Plaza, comes to an almost complete stop, when Johnson's car rolls into Dealey Plaza, three car lanes behind Johnson, but behind Kennedy, pardon me. But before the first bullet is fired,
yeah,
Johnson hits the deck. He's on the floor in his car before the first shot is fired. How do we know this? There's photographic proof.
I mean, that's incredibly
Johnson missing.
Right, right. I mean, that's an incredibly damning piece of evidence, isn't it? I have heard that before, and that's from photographs, right? That's not from the Zapruder film.
Well, it's not only recorded in photographs, it's also recorded in the memoirs of Senator Ralph Yarborough. So you have a second corroboration. Johnson is not only on the floor, but he is huddled around and listening to a walkie-talkie radio. What is he listening for? Johnson will pressure a Secret Service agent, Rufus Youngblood, to lie to the Warren Commission and claim that he pushed Johnson to the floor after hearing the first shot.
I see.
But after Johnson's death, Youngblood admits that that's not the truth, that he said that because Johnson demanded he say it. Johnson was the president of the United States. So Johnson's actions before, during, and after the Kennedy assassination all point the finger at him.
Can we talk a little about what happened after the assassination and LBJ did that you believe is suspicious?
Well, a number of things happened that are interesting. First of all, the number of people who say that Johnson did this is extraordinary. Jackie Kennedy, who can't get the time of day from American intelligence, goes to French intelligence. She is, of course, French. She speaks the language. She's the toast of Paris. They conduct their own investigation. They determine that LBJ did it. We know from a declassified document that we get in 1992, a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to Lyndon Johnson, that the KGB, the Russian KGB, conducted their own exhaustive investigation. They also determined that Lyndon Johnson is the perpetrator of the murder. Jack Ruby, who is utilized by the mob to silence Lee Harvey Oswald. He's asked by reporters while he's in handcuffs being led down a hallway, Jack, how could this happen? If Adlai Stevenson were vice president, Jack Ruby says, this never would have happened. What do you mean, Jack? What are you saying? Yells the reporter.
Yeah.
Look at the man who's in there now, the man at the top. Look at the man who's in there now, at the very top. Jack Ruby is referring to Lyndon Johnson. Ruby begs the Warren Commission to be moved from Dallas to Washington, where he says he'll tell the complete truth. But in Dallas, he says his life is in danger. Warren refuses to take him to Washington. Ultimately, I believe that Ruby is murdered in prison. A doctor comes to visit him when he has a cold, gives him an injection, and shortly thereafter, he is found to have terminal cancer and dies shortly thereafter. So all the loose ends are tied up by Lyndon Johnson and his friends.
Indeed. Can I ask you, do you think that Johnson had any direct involvement in the shenanigans that went on in the hospital during the autopsy, which has certainly been explored by many different researchers? Do you think that was actually in any way Johnson's work, or was that just another aspect of the very complex conspiracy here?
I suspect Johnson's fully aware of the fact that the a major effort will be made to obscure the real wounds of JFK. But we do know Johnson calls the doctor at Parkland Hospital when Lee Harvey Oswald is dying on the operating table and demands that the doctor get a confession from him. The president himself, Lyndon Johnson.
Indeed.
and that is very curious in itself.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I've been talking to my guest Roger Stone about the Kennedy assassination. Mr. Stone, unfortunately, you've got to go. You've got some very important television interviews to do. I just would like to ask you one last question before we go. Obviously, the assassination now is 50 years in the past, and many people sort of who don't really understand the importance of it, as I do, and many of the listeners to this show do, will say that this is something that really is of the past. Can you just tell us why this is so important and why justice needs to be done now?
Because the truth is always important, because the American people need to know that America had a coup d'etat on November 22nd, 1963, And we need to be certain it doesn't happen again. The government is entirely capable of this, whether they're lying to you about Benghazi or whether they're lying to us about federal health care, or regardless. So I think the moral of the story is the truth is important. We have to establish the truth to ensure that this does not happen again.
Indeed, I certainly agree with you on that. So thank you very much for coming on. I'd love to have you on the show again to get into some of the many, many aspects of this. But it has been great talking to you today, sir.
We'd love to do that.
Terrific. Okay, thank you.
Many thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, that certainly was a very interesting excursion there into a very, very important subject. And I would like to do more on the topic of the Kennedy assassination. There is so much to explore. It's a very, very important topic for truth and justice, for the whole, really, for the whole of civilization in the current age we live in. America being the most powerful country in the world, and of course, you know, Kennedy being probably the most iconic figure of the 20th century. The assassination of Kennedy is a symbol of the deterioration of the quality of our civilization. Along with that, there's an aspect of this that I would also like to get into in a lot more detail in this show, which is the question of psychopathy and how individuals who we can describe as psychopaths are able to manipulate themselves into positions of power so easily within the current system, and how to defend ourselves against that. Now, of course, Johnson is a classic textbook case of a psychopath. I've got the Hare psychopathy checklist here, and clearly Johnson exhibits so many of the features on this checklist: the grandiosity, the pathological lying, the lack of remorse and guilt, the impulsivity, and of course the narcissism and criminal versatility. These are all aspects of psychopathy, as is promiscuous sexual behaviour. And indeed, in the book, in Roger Stone's book, Kennedy's sexual escapades feature largely, and it's not something I wish to judge a person on, but the point here is that these factors come together as a constellation. Individually, these characteristics might not be particularly pathological, but when they all come together in one individual, we certainly do have really the clinical definition of a psychopath. Now, of course, in most of the documentaries and academic pieces you'll see on psychopaths, they tend to focus on marginalized members of society, people who are in prison, people who certainly aren't in positions of power. And you can understand why that might be, because, of course, people who are in positions of power are very difficult to analyze and approach. And, of course, they don't want to be exposed. But I think this gives us a very warped impression of what the real prevalence for psychopathy is. If you watch these documentaries, you'll tend to think that psychopaths are just an aberrant form of personality who are marginal, who you will tend to find in prison. Now, of course, prisons do have a higher than normal representation of psychopaths, that is true, but I do not believe that this constellation, that this psychological constellation of features is largely restricted to people who are on the fringes of society. I think it is very much more prominent within the higher echelons of the people who are actually running the show in our society. And of course, I'm just giving you that as my opinion, my subjective opinion, but there are many independent researchers who have formed the same opinion. And I want to bring to you a clip here from one such researcher, Thomas Sheridan. And what I like about his approach to this is that he really does look at psychopaths in positions of power. And he doesn't shy away from that. And he recognizes that these are the real threat, and these are the real problem, and these are the ones we have to deal with. These are the ones that are able to cover their tracks. And unless we can learn how to confront and expose them, we are all at great risk, ladies and gentlemen. So let me play to you now a clip here from Thomas Sheridan in a public lecture talking about psychopaths.
And then about the mid-1990s, through a series of circumstances, I became very interested in the field of psychopathology, mainly because I was working at Goldman Sachs at the time and I was surrounded by psychopaths. I was a graphic designer, so I'm guiltless of any in terms of anything that you may be suffering from those people. It's kind of ironic, is I used to be an employee of Goldman Sachs, and since the yes vote went through in Ireland the other day, magically, I'm a Goldman Sachs employee once again, just like all Irish citizens. So everything comes full circle, unfortunately. Now, as Ian said, I ordered a book called Puzzling People, which did fairly well. And my original idea with the book was to actually deal with the subject in the sort of the geopolitical sense. And then I had a website, and it was like a message board, and I was doing development. And more I found out that these issues impacted people in their personal lives as well. It wasn't just, you know, a case of psychopathic politicians, business leaders. It was also embedded within every aspect of society. And what was also very uncanny to me was how all the traits and the pathologies of people who experienced a psychopath in their personal life, whether it was a bully at work, a dangerous relationship, or just someone that abused and moved in our family or their friends or whatever, or broke up a social circle in a committee or something, it was exactly the same methodology they used to destroy those people as what the ones at the top, the psychopaths at the top, do to mess up the rest of us and to mess this world up. So this became a kind of a maxim. It was the idea of, like, as above, so below. Became like, what the psychopath you meet in your life is the same as the psychopath that runs the world. So it became a very powerful tool for me personally, because I could take people's personal experience and allow them to scale it up to the world. And suddenly, not only does their life make sense, or strange issues in their life, or strange periods of their life make sense, but also the world begins to make sense, because you suddenly understand that we're actually a species under attack. I know that may sound like a hyperbole, but there's actually two species of human beings on this earth. There's the empathic, normal human being, and there's the predatory element within the human race, which are known as psychopaths. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, this is going to be a dark kind of thing. It may trigger memories that some of you have had of people you knew in your past. In fact, I'll be surprised if it didn't trigger any memories, because everybody in some way has been impacted on this. Before I start, do not be diagnosing yourself while I'm doing this, because we all have many of the traits. Okay, the difference between, and we've all done things in our lives that we're ashamed of and we shouldn't have done, but the difference between us and a psychopath is we actually cared at what we've done. We know right from wrong. We often did it out of stupidity or selfishness, but it wasn't done out of a planned methodological way to destroy another human being or another entity or to capitalize on destroying an organization. We just found ourselves, like any other human being, shit happens. A psychopath is very different. They know exactly what they're doing. They will plan it to the nth degree, and they will carry it out without a care in the world and absolutely no compassion, remorse, or any kind of even consideration of what they've done to others. It's just business. Now, what is a psychopath really? Well, the term psychopath has been in use for about 100 years, more or less around from the 1880s, 1890s on. In the 1940s, it was scientifically quantified by an American psychiatrist called Herbie Kleckley, who wrote a groundbreaking book called The Mask of Sanity.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm playing to you a clip here by Thomas Sheridan talking about psychopaths. Do stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It is awesome to have your company today. Well, after listening to that really chilling description of Lyndon Johnson from author Roger Stone in the previous section there, I thought it would be worthwhile getting a bit of a primer on psychopaths and psychopathy, because clearly Lyndon Johnson was a psychopath, and understanding this type of personality is really important, folks. It will open the door to explaining many, many crimes, great and small. And as Thomas Sheridan says here in the clip I'm playing for you today, the behavior of psychopaths is replicated both on the micro and the macro level. You'll see the same techniques in psychopaths who you might meet in your daily life acted out by psychopaths who are at the highest levels of government. So let's continue now with the audio clip from Thomas Sheridan.
And he described the psychopath as a fully functioning mimic of an otherwise normal human being who hides an internal chaos behind a mask of sanity and then uses this mask of sanity to impose their sense of internal chaos upon a person, an individual, a family, an organization, an entire continent. It's the same thing. They create order for themselves by imposing their chaos upon us. Now, psychopaths are, according to Western figures, I've used the official figures here, I think this might actually be a little high. I think it'd probably be close to 3% or 2%. But I'm just going what the NHS in the UK, the European Union, and the North American figures, they round off to 4% of this population is psychopathic to some degree. That means the vast majority of them are just shifty users, manipulators, parasites who just use people, discard them as if they're an old Coke can, and walk on as if they never existed, all the way up to serial killers, politicians, and the big business leaders who have the world in a mess today with this sort of predatory, pathological capitalism that we're living under. They excel in corporations, media, and government. They're all social parasites. No psychopath is capable of autonomy in their own lives or in any other case. They live off the energy, sweat, labours, capital, and emotions of others. This is why they do so well within particularly things like media, because they hide behind these personas and these masks. As I said, they hide behind a mask of sanity. What's in there is quite different than what the rest of us is. They have difficulty processing information across the cerebral cortex, the cerebral partitions of their brain. So they their brain is functioning. It's not like their brain damaged. It's not like, you know, there's lots of stuff out there to try and make out their brain damaged. They're not brain damaged. Their brains are like us. They just don't. They just choose not to use the parts of their brain that contain empathy and so on for others. It's a horses for courses kind of situation. It's just like when you develop your brain, it will according to your needs in life. We'll be talking about that later on. They project their internal psychological chaos onto their targets. This is a sign of all pathology, not just psychopathology, is the idea that I would take my faults and then project them upon you. If I was working in a place and I was stealing the stuff, I would say, and I was caught, I would try to make out that the boss was stealing from somebody else and somehow I deserve to do this. If I attacked you and beat you up, my rationale would be, well, you deserved it. I should have attacked you before you attacked me. They live in a state where they're always trying to get you before you get them. And this is often done through projection, by projecting their faults onto you. And they're incapable of being cured, and they see nothing wrong with their behavior. See, this is an important point. This is what makes my work very different than many other people. Because I'm not an academic, I'm not owned by anybody. I'm not owned by a university. I'm not owned by a government. I don't play the mainstream media game, and my information is getting out there for the simple reason that I know from all the work that I've done, it is not rooted in some kind of neurological, thus so far, or DNA thing. The proof just isn't there. There's a lot of wishful thinking, there's a lot of suggestion, there's a lot of paths being followed to bring us to that point, but it still hasn't been there yet. They just seem to appear. Out of completely normal families. There was a recent article in the New York Times where they had a very disturbing article, but very insightful and very important for the mainstream media to actually acknowledge this at last, about childhood psychopaths, children who are actually psychopaths, and they got them to the center in Florida. And all these children came from normal, loving homes. They were not products of inner city ghettos, alcoholic parents, or misuse, or, you know, no love. They just seem, and the other siblings in the family were normal. They just seem to arrive. You know, and this is an excuse that's kind of always used. Like, oh, well, psychopaths are a product of a poor environment and bad families and bad nutrition and no education and so on. I mean, I didn't know that Tony Blair was born in the South Bronx or somewhere like that. And this is what we have to deal with. They're everywhere. This is why I wrote this book, because there's an element. All the work has been done on prisoners, in male prisoners, and it's very handy for the control system to deflect psychopathology upon the working classes and the poor and marginalized groups, so we're not looking at them. This is always why they filled us with the idea of the serial killer and Norman Bates. They're always keeping our eye off the ball. And they see nothing wrong with their behavior, and they're never cured. It's been shown in MRI scans and diagnostic testing right until they're old people in prison or in the retirement homes. They're exactly the same. They're just as predatory as what they were when they were in their teens and 20s. It's just they don't have the energy anymore to go about it, but they'll be still doing things like stealing money off the other residents and tampering with their medication and so on. Now, they all have a series of behaviors that they all undertake. And this is what makes them very easy to identify after you've made yourself fully knowledgeable. It's not, you just can't read my books or any other books or see a video and walk down the street and go, he's a psychopath, she's a psychopath. That's a very dangerous thing to do, because it creates a witch hunt mentality. However, if you find yourself in a job, a relationship, or even you're seeing it in the global thing, in the sort of the financial or political, geopolitical sphere, if you have this knowledge that I'm giving you today, it can help unlock a sort of a path out of a labyrinth that doesn't make any sense to something that does make some sense, that you're actually dealing with a psychopathic individual. The first one you should look out for is a thing called gaslighting. This comes from an old movie called Gaslight, where the plot of the film was that a wealthy widow was being driven slowly insane by her husband. He was doing things like turning down the gas lights in their apartment and telling her there's no change in the light, so that was to make her believe she was going mad. This is what they do. They try to impose their insanity upon us by making us think we're insane in order to manipulate us and control us. I got a letter last year from a guy in America. His father he'd been working away from his father. His father lived alone, and he'd been living in this house, a suburban house. And a young guy moved in, and he was very friendly next door. And the young guy one day noticed, some of your slates are hanging off your roof. Let me fix it for you. So we're out the old guy even saying yes or no, he pulled the ladder up, got up on the roof and tidied the slates. When he got down, the old guy said, oh, that's great, how much do I owe you? And he says, ah, that's what neighbours are for. You see, they're very charismatic, they get you this way, they're very friendly at first. He goes, that's what neighbours are for, sure, we're pals now, we might as well be friends. And then the old guy said, well, do you want to come in and have a beer or something? So he brought him in, and then the next thing he knows, he's the surrogate son. The young guy is coming over all the time, they're watching the sports on the TV, and the old guy suddenly feels young again. He has a friend who's like 40 years younger, nice, friendly young guy who helps him with chores, and his son is away. So this young guy next door is fulfilling these missing needs in the psychopath's life, and you find this is very common. And then one day out of the blue, the young psychopathic young guy walks in, and gets the remote control and switches off the TV. And the old guy goes, why did you do that? And he goes, what do you mean? You just switched off the TV while watching the baseball. And he goes, I didn't switch off the TV. And he goes, you did. I just see you pick up the remote and I saw you switch it off. And the psychopath goes, what are you on about? We're watching the game right now. And they said they're so convincing at lying and they're so dangerous at mind games and they're so wicked in this regard. This is not a sick person who needs our love and help, because this is a dangerous predator we're dealing with. And what happened eventually was he was trying to make the old guy believe he had Alzheimer's and then sign over his estate to him. And fortunately, the son returned in time to stop it. But this is that's called gaslighting. Projection, we've already spoken about, projecting their faults onto you. A psychopath.
I'll just leave it there. It's a really interesting lecture there by Thomas Sheridan. I think it's really important to understand the nature of the games that these type of people play. They are, in a sense, games. These people are motivated to play out. It's a predator's game. And when you think about this, consider the behavior of the predator in the wild. There's been a lot of great documentaries that have shown you the way predators behave in the wild. I've seen some excellent David Attenborough shows that demonstrate the way in which killer whales will behave towards seals that they are basically hunting. They will play with them. They will torment them. They will torture them. There is something intrinsic to the predatory state of mind that seems to involve this type of behavior. Now, of course, when we see this in the natural world, most simple example is a cat with a mouse. When we see this in the natural world, we see it as an expression of basic instincts. And it is actually not something that we see as dark or evil. Although, if you map that onto human behavior, and specifically if you map it onto human behavior in relation to other human beings, it is really the definition of evilness. It is actually intrinsically wicked. So there are aspects to this, I think, that we need to study to understand more, because you can look at it from a philosophical point of view, you can look at it from a metaphysical, spiritual point of view, or you can look at it from the point of view of biology and natural history. But I think that the agenda, the objective for all of us who are trying to make a better world should be to try and understand it in a way that we can heal it. Because it is a sickness within our society, and it is manifest to an alarming degree among all of those people who occupy positions of great power in our society. I think by understanding it, we begin to take away some of its power. It's a complex topic. We've reached the end of the show for this week. It's been awesome talking to you today, and I will be back next week. I'll see you then.